Hello and welcome to Particular, a podcast that talks about particular topics and ideas in not a particular way. My name is Anastasia Vortnikova. Our today's guest is Misha Zakharov, a film critic. We have met during our studies in VGIK, and I was always interested in what Misha is going to do after graduating. Now he's doing his PhD in the UK, wrote a book, and continues to explore the world of cinema and share his knowledge with the audience. A quick note, in the show we mention a lot of films and books, and you can check them in the description box. So, let's get started. Misha, hi. Welcome to my podcast. Should I call you Misha or Michael, or how do you prefer to call yourself in the UK?
No, Misha is fine. Like, I'm usually, like, I tend to call myself Misha, and I just want people to address myself as Misha. Yeah.
Okay, that's good. We figured that out. And a quick disclaimer for our listeners. Me and Misha, we studied in one university, not in the same year, but yeah, we did meet sometimes, but it wasn't like we were close friends. So I'm really interested to get to know you today, to get to know more about you. And also to talk about I think it's a shared experience of us being part of a LGBTQI plus community and being from Russia, which is quite a hard topic, I would say. And especially with the whole situation, I think I'm always very considerate talking about like my Russian experience, understanding that the war is going on and it's quite like there are more important things to talk about. But I think for people that have stayed in Russia and also with the new law coming up, and like I think it was already, it passed already in the government with the propaganda. So I think it's really important to talk about that. So I wanted to start with the first question and ask you about, because I don't really remember, were you out when we were in uni or were you like not talking about that much about it?
Yeah, I was pretty much out all the time, like when I moved to Moscow. I mean, already while I was living in my hometown, I was pretty much out. But in Moscow, I never really, I never concealed anything. So yeah, I mean, I think I came out to my classmates, like maybe on the second week or maybe on the third. So just, I mean, I just wanted to put everything on the table so that like there would be no misunderstanding. And yeah, it was, I mean, everyone was accepting. And yeah, going back to what you said about war and then the anti-LGBTQ plus law, it's like, it's very difficult to kind of make small talk now. You know, like when you meet new people and when they ask you where you come from, it's always a challenge. Because you it's a knot that you have to kind of unwind, and you have to like give all the details. With me, it's even more difficult, I guess, because of my mixed ethnicity, because of my Korean descent. It's also like it complicates things a lot, and it's sometimes difficult to explain to people like that I'm not just Russian but also Korean. And I think we will touch upon that later. But yeah, going back to VGIK, I think I was pretty privileged in that I never really faced any homophobia, academically speaking. Like I was able to write whatever I wanted to. And I went to the conferences, like in 2018, let's say in December 2018, I presented a paper on the Russian documentary films on queer people. And this is the paper that I'm actually currently translating and reworking in order to present it perhaps at some other conference. Also, like, I've written, like, I literally, like, I've written a term paper titled Queering Larissa Shepitka's Wings, or because of how, I mean, like queer-coded this film is, even though like it's a Soviet melodrama, it's still like super, like there is a subtext and there are like two women dancing at some points in the film together. Yeah, so apart from that, there was also, like, let's say, a term paper on queer domesticity in several, like, festival films, including Ruben Campillo's Eastern Boys. And yeah, so I was pretty, like, and even in my final thesis, I've discussed three films with, like, which were either implicitly or explicitly queer, and those were Volga Volga by Vladislav Mamashev-Monro, which is a remake of the, like, a reenactment of the Grigory Aleksandrov's film from 1930s. It's also My Dear Hands, I think it's, like, the international title of it, the film by Alexander Minidze, and also The Hammer and the Sickle by Sergei Livnev, I think from 1994. And all of those films kind of deconstructed socialist elite canon in very inventive ways, including, like, queer subversion. So even in my, like, final thesis, I've written about queer stuff. So academically speaking, like, I wasn't really discriminated or anything. And, like, Mikhail Shvitkoy, who was the, I think he was, like, the previous prime minister of culture, like, a minister of culture in Russia. I think maybe he didn't actually read my thesis, because, I mean, they never do that kind of stuff, but he was on the board when I was defending my thesis, and, like, no one really cared about it, because I think that historically there are a lot of queer people in film, especially in film studies, but on the other hand, I had to share my room at the dormitory with some people who were quite homophobic. Like, one of my roommates was very religious, very orthodox, and with him we kind of had some issues. But for the last 2.5 years, I think I lived with the best possible roommate, who was Maxim Pecherski, and you probably know him as well.
Yeah.
Who is now an award-winning filmmaker. And even though it sounds fancy, like, he's not, I don't think he's thinking of himself that way, but I think that he's, like, super promising, and maybe he's, like, one of the most talented filmmakers of this generation. I hope that he will manage to make new works. Yeah.
And because I wasn't out when I was in uni, so for me, this experience, I can't really relate. So I was kind of, like, you know, not talking about it, not trying to showcase it in any way. So for me, like, even I was also living in the dorms, and I haven't seen any homophobia, even though I was, like, really pro LGBTQI plus rights and talking about it all the time. So basically the whole atmosphere was very friendly and welcoming, I would say. But sometimes from the teachers and from professors, I would hear some kind of, like, you know, very conservative views, very conservative sayings about certain things. And even I remember, I think it was my second or third year, there was, or maybe first year, I don't really remember, but there was a Geek Film Festival. It was an international film festival, and they were showing, I don't remember the name of the film, but they had to turn it off because there was a gay sex scene. And it was on the fourth floor in the main cinema, it was quite surprising for me, because I always considered our university very, very progressive in that way. So for me, yeah, it was quite surprising. But also, I think you and me, if you will agree with me on that, we were kind of privileged to be in this bubble and this kind of atmosphere, like, with people, and, like, even outside university with people who we hang out with, they were mostly welcoming. And I'm interested because you're not from Moscow, you're from Smolensk, am I right?
Yeah.
So how was it for you back there when you were growing up? How was your relationship with your family and with your classmates back at school before you came to uni?
I mean, it was ugly. I would say like it's a textbook example of how ugly it can be for queer but also Asian kids to grow up in a small town, which is in the west of Russia. Smolensk is like on the Russian-Belarus border, so you can get to Vitebsk or Minsk in no time. But it also means that like it's almost exclusively white. Like, let's say if I would be growing up in in Yakutia or in the like far east of Russia or in some other place which is more diverse, you know, ethnically, I would probably not face that level of discrimination. But in Smolensk, it kind of there were like two layers, so like several layers of discrimination. So one was the anti-gay discrimination, but then there was also like anti-Asian, like basically racism, and it was quite difficult. I think at the age of 14 or maybe 15, I don't remember, I was outed as a bisexual actually at my class, and this is the experience that I also describe in my book. But that kind of changed everything, because I've lost all of my friends, like all the people whom I thought were my friends, they weren't in the end. And then I just kind of started, I don't remember how it happened, but I just started reading a lot and watching like a lot of films. And that basically became my refuge, especially cinema. Like cinema became my refuge and a place where I could kind of lose myself or just seek some solace or find like-minded people. So I just kind of tried to, you might call it a form of escapism, but I think it's very characteristic of LGBTQ plus people growing up. I think like a lot of people had that experience, and it's now even fictionalized. Like you can watch films about this kind of, you know, very sad, very goth teens who are trying to figure out their sexuality. So that is also like a plus, that this experience at least is currently being portrayed and you don't feel like you are kind of left out. But yeah, for me it was quite difficult to grow up, because I was I was called names. I was called, which is also surprising, like, you know, the fact that being called Chinese in Russia is also kind of derogatory, or like, you know, even though it's just a kind of a matter of fact thing, like it's just a nationality, basically. It doesn't carry any like negative connotations per se, but when you're called Chinese, it's almost as if it's like an expletive or something. And I was called like Chinese, Tajik, whatever. Like I was never actually called Korean, which is also surprising. I was called either Chinese or Japanese, but never Korean. Maybe it never occurred to people that there are actually more nationalities in the East. And I had some LGBTQ plus friends in Smolensk. One of them was an older lesbian, and another was a bisexual male, and I think that's about it. Like I only had those two friends. But when I moved to Moscow, obviously, yeah, I knew like a lot of people. But that, I mean, again, as you said, it's a kind of a bubble. And actually, I would never say that I belong to LGBTQ plus community. And I don't even, I don't know whether such thing exists in Russia, whether it's like, I mean, sometimes it feels like a unicorn, like some sort of mythical creature. It feels like it doesn't really, I mean, it is supposed to be there. Like we're always like, well, the community is there and like there are people to support you, But in the end, it's like, you know, maybe five or six people who form a sort of a clique or like a very tight circle. And I had those friends mostly from the arts, like fashion, cinema, contemporary art, but it didn't extend, like this tight circle, it didn't really extend. It didn't form like a real community. And I think this is what I also lacked while growing up. Even now, like, I don't feel like like I'm currently in the UK and I don't really feel like I belong here or that I'm part of any kind of community here, apart maybe from the academic one, which is sad. And back in Moscow, I always felt a bit alien because I was interested in things that were unfashionable or too obscure or too kind of, you know, too highbrow maybe for some people. And I kind of occupied this liminal space where I was on the one hand, I was a person from small town, so I was quite conscious of my class background. I was also very much conscious of my like racial background, sexual background, but then I kind of tried to fit into a very different world, which wasn't very accepting. And I think I'm still kind of traumatized by that experience, by how kind of classist and very elitist this entire industry was, like film industry, but also like contemporary art. I mean, there is probably nothing worse than contemporary art. I like to think of myself, and I do that in my book as well, like I like to think of myself intersectionally. So I think that like a lot of things have to be considered, and like class and race and like sexual identity, all of those things, they kind of come together to form a very like particular story. And
I totally feel you, and I can relate to a lot of things you said, because I was growing up, I knew from quite an early age that I was gay, and for me it was always a form of escapism into cinema, and maybe that was the main reason I decided to pursue like cinema studies and also work in that field. And yeah, it was really hard for me because I was always trying to be to fit in, and being a lesbian, and basically growing up in a small town, and having no people that I knew like who had like any kind of like different sexual orientation than straight was really, really hard for me. And I only met LGBTQI plus like community or people in Moscow only when I went to uni. And for me, it was also very scary to come out, because I always thought that for me to fit in and to like, for example, be successful in the job I want and to pursue the career I want, I need to be kind of, you know, very standard, very filling in all the criterias. But like maybe in my final years, I only understood that it's like, it's the opposite of being successful in a way, like, because you don't get to show your true self. And as soon as I came out to myself and came out to my mom and my close friends, I understood that I got this freedom that I was looking for, and like in artistic way as well, because when you're so trying to kind of, you know, get rid of your true self and try to hide it somewhere in the closet, as they would say, you don't get to express yourself. And for you, this escapism into cinema, was it the main reason you decided to pursue to become a film critic and to study it in uni, or was it something else?
I mean, it wasn't like a conscious decision. I think it was very natural. There was like a natural flow to it. So it was more like a vacation, you know, like a religious vacation. I think the right, like people usually describe it that way. So, I mean, first I started just watching tons of LGBTQ plus content, like films, but also like TV series. And then I just started like preparing myself for VGeek. And VGeek was, you know, the dream that many of us had, which we kind of became very much disillusioned in
Oh,
when
yeah,
we
for
actually,
sure.
when we were actually in, we were like, you know, and people always think of VGeek as this kind of big shot university where, Pudovkin, Davchenko, Eisenstein, but also Muratova, Shipitka, Hamdamov, Litvinova, all of those like celebrities either studied or taught or both. And it feels like you're always starstruck at the thought of it, but like when you're actually there, you understand like how corrupt and how like perverse the entire institution is, and like how it's relies on the Soviet's legacy, like on this. It's almost like, you know, there is this film like The Shard of the Empire, or like the like you know, I think it's, yeah, you know the film. So it's almost like, you know, like a huge piece of the empire that is still there, but it's derelict. It's like it's completely obsolete. It's very old school in terms of how things are taught. And then I just kind of when I realized how, like when I entered VGeek and when I realized that I'm not gonna get anything out of it, I just started maybe you might call it like networking my way through. Like I wasn't really aware of the fact that like this term networking actually exists, but I just started to meet people and I started working, I think, with like during my second year at Garage. And then I just started like circulating between three interconnected areas, which are publishing, contemporary art, and cinema. And in none of those I found complete satisfaction. But together, combined, they kind of formed a new, like when I got everything that I needed from those three combined, I kind of felt fulfilled. And I guess that's how I just that's how I lived. Because it's also like, I mean, it's very difficult. It was very difficult to survive as a precarious worker in the contemporary arts industry, in film industry. Just have to kind of just have to get by. And it's also, I mean, something that is very characteristic, I think, of LGBTQ plus experience, because there are always this young, and that is, you know, I'm maybe generalizing here, but there are always these young gay people who are like super ambitious, who are trying to make it, and who are constantly like gate kept, or there is this glass ceiling or whatever that kind of, you know, prohibits you from going further. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with homophobia. Sometimes it has to do with like a lot of other things. I think in my career, I don't think I've ever been discriminated against. Like in my career as a film critic, I was never persecuted or whatever. Only after the like this new infamous anti-LGBTQ plus law has been introduced earlier this month, like I think it was on the 9th of December, three of my texts, which were previously published on Seriously, they were removed without my approval. So one of them was on Asian American experience in film. And there was a mention, I think, of at least four queer filmmakers, which were Alice Wu, Patrick Wan, Isabel Sandoval, and Andrew An. And then also two of my texts on trans and non-binary films and filmmakers. Those were also removed. And this is, I think, like, and this came as a shock to me because I was trying to find those texts. I think I wanted maybe to... maybe to send the link to somebody, or maybe I wanted to translate something from those texts, and I just couldn't find them, and that was very upsetting. Another, like, I think one time that kind of stands out in particular was in 2020, like it was later 2020, and I was, late 2021 actually. So it was a year ago, and which seems like an eternity ago. And I was organizing a series of screenings at Garage. That was my first actual program at Garage as a programmer. And it was titled How Are Things in the West? New German Cinema Answers, or New German Cinema Report. And so that was a series of six screenings dedicated to lesser known filmmakers of the new German cinema. So we all know Wenders or Herzog or like Margareta von Trotta, but there are still so many of them whom we kind of we do not. And so I wanted to highlight specifically female and queer voices of the new German cinema, like Helke Zander, but also Helma Zander's Brahms, Werner Schroeter, also this kind of obscure German-Iranian filmmaker, Sahrab Shahid Sales, who is also very interesting, especially in terms of like diasporic cinema, diasporic filmmaking. And also I wanted to screen Rosa von Braunheim's seminal film from 1971, which is It Is Not the Homosexual Who is Perverse, but the Society He Lives In. And you can tell by the title that like it's some kind of very scandalous stuff. And the film actually jump-started the gay movement in the Western Germany. And so I was very keen to screen that, and then in Ijevsk, where the new edition of the Garage Film Garage Screen Film Festival was being held, in Ijevsk they screened Paris is Burning as part mm-hmm. of that festival, and you know, like, Ijevsk is not the first place to come to mind when yeah. you think about that film. So and no one really expected anything of it, but they had a full house, and there was a secret drag show in the end. There was even a DJ set, and it was very kind of vibey, very like everyone had fun, I guess. But next day after that, the curators of that space in Ijevsk, I think it's called Sharing Culture, the curators were contacted by an FSB curator who was attached to Sharing Culture. And he was like, what the fuck are you showing here? Like, what are you crazy? Like, have you gone mad? Why are you showing this? And then the news reached Garage. And then Garage, it came as a shock that, like, they were people who actually, you know, surveilled, who actually were kind of on the lookout. And so I was told no. Like, I was told by my colleagues at Garage that we cannot screen Rosa von Braunheim's film because yeah. it's too risky, too dangerous. And I realized how dangerous it is now. And that was the kind of, like, the only time that I actually exercised a sort of self-censorship. But other than that, I cannot really remember. I don't think I was ever censored or whatever. I was gate-kept, I would say. Like, it was difficult for me to make my way through because I wasn't really taken seriously, or I was just thought of as an eccentric or as a person who is too into all of that kind of progressive stuff, or all of that, I mean, in Russian we have the word podestka, but I don't even know how to translate it into English. It's like something that is, the hot topic, maybe. Yeah, the hot topic probably would be the right translation. So, and there were people who were like, "Oh, you're so interested in all of these like hot topics, like Asian American cinema or like gay cinema. Oh, it's so like so super progressive." So, and I mean, and I would say that, okay, yeah, I am interested in that kind of stuff, but not for the reasons of it being kind of hot topic, but for the reasons of like, these people being underrepresented, and like the also my own experience being underrepresented. So yeah, I was gatekept, but I guess now it doesn't really matter because I do not really consider myself part of that community or part of that world anymore, like Russian film community, or like I cannot really associate myself with that.
I totally agree. I don't know if I don't associate myself with it, but I'm just, I'm feeling so hopeless and not really seeing a way of how things can change back in Russia, because basically maybe a year ago, no, 2 years ago, when my girlfriend, she came to Russia. She's Russian, but she lived in the UK for 12 years already, and she came to Moscow, and like basically we lived in Moscow like for maybe 6 months, and we were very open, I would say. Like, we didn't hide anything. We were very open in the public. We were like, we I told all my friends about my relationship, and I've lost a lot of friends because of that, which was, I'm not sad about it, to be honest, and it's good that I found out that they were homophobic now than later. But at the same time, we met a lot of LGBT people in Moscow, but they were all very, very low key. And I was like, but basically, if there was a community, and if we could be more open about it, if we could talk more about it, maybe there would be hope, and maybe there would be a way of us changing something. But now, even seeing like people that stayed, or even people that went away from Russia and maybe moved to another countries, they're still very low key. So is it something like, maybe, like, for example, you were never low key about it. You were interested about these topics. Like, for example, I wasn't low key about it. Are we different? Is something wrong with us, or is it like something wrong with them? Like, I don't really understand like what should change in them and in us for this LGBT community in Russia to be more like, be more open about it, or maybe even try to change something in terms of laws. Because yeah, I understand like we can't change the laws that are happening now, like for example, like with war and everything, but in terms of LGBT before the war, I think something could have been done. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I do agree, but it also has to do with a more general problem of Russians being completely apolitical, like completely out of, they don't really, out of context, I would guess. Like, people do not really care, I think. And I think I faced that many times when I was, especially when I was communicating with younger gays, these kind of Moscow white gays who are completely shallow, petty, completely like, basically people who are obsessed with sex or money, maybe, but not with politics or something that is, very relevant. And not in that kind of, hot topic kind of way, but that actually is relevant. And And this also, I think, the reason why the war came as a shock for all of us, because we were completely oblivious to many of the things that were happening around. And I guess that one of the like paradoxical advantages, or maybe like upsides of the war, is that Russia is currently undergoing a decolonization of sorts, and there are so many voices, like Asian voices, but also like indigenous voices, so many organizations like Free Buryatia Foundation or Agents of Russia, who are currently, you know, experiencing an upheaval and who are finally speaking out their truth, which was, you know, I think it would be impossible, like maybe 2-5 years ago, like no one would care. And like Yakut cinema is still considered to be a sort of like an exotic relic, but not like really something that is well established and that is, you know, like part of the international festival movement. So I think like this sort of detoxicizing that you are speaking about, I think it has to happen on many levels, and it's not just about like gay people, like LGBTQ plus people suddenly becoming very aware of their situation, but it also has to do with like many communities that have to work together on, I mean on dismantling Russian state probably. And this sounds like a super utopian, or like a super, like it's very difficult to achieve, obviously. And like it's only it can be my New Year's wish that kind of, you know, Russia collapses yeah. and that it's finally, you know, dissected into many different states, like many different areas. But I mean, this is the only logical outcome probably, because this is how all of the empires end. I mean, they end by collapsing and by splitting into, I mean, smaller regions, like smaller states. Yeah, but I mean, coming back to that idea of low-key, I never really considered myself an activist, because I think for me it was a kind of maybe there was a set of limitations that came with that. Like I didn't really want to pigeonhole myself. I didn't really want to call myself an activist. And also, I really kind of I don't like being loud in like in many senses of that word. Like I don't really like to be loud. So I kind of did my share of activism by translating queer authors. Including like a Latin American transgender author. I worked on highlighting queer cinema, programming or writing about it. I've written like an entire book on gay Asian experience in Russia. So I was kind of trying to do as much as I can, but like by my own, you know, means, like my own very humble, I would say, means, but I was just doing my share, let's say, and I'm continuing to do that, but now on a kind of on an actual activist level, because I'm currently in the UK doing my PhD, which is a hybrid practice as research project. And I'm supposed to work at the Screen and Rights Film Festival, which is a social justice film festival in the West Midlands. And it is held annually in both Coventry, where I'm based now, and in Birmingham. And and my current supervisor also happens to be the director of that festival. And she doesn't really like the term human rights because she thinks that it has become very commodified, very kind of, you know, it's very easy to sell human rights, but it's very difficult to actually fight for them or to affect social change. And so she likes to think of this festival as a social justice film festival, which also sounds more appealing to me as well.
Yeah.
Because it's, I mean, you can, by the means of cinema, you can basically see the mechanism of social justice at work. And this is what I like kind of about this idea of a social justice film festival. Yeah. And so now I'm currently, I'm kind of, radicalizing, you might say, because now I can actually call myself an activist, maybe like an activist programmer, and I also need to theorize that, like what it actually means to be like an activist curator, an activist film programmer, or an activist film critic for that matter. So yeah, this is something very interesting, but I already have so many the history is so rich, like there are so many predecessors, like I'm not the first person to do that, because I'm currently researching Sarah Schulman, who is one of my favorite authors. She is an AIDS historian and archivist. She's also a film programmer and a novelist, film producer and screenwriter. And she worked on... like apart from being a famous AIDS activist, perhaps the like the AIDS activist, at least of the New York AIDS pandemic in the 80s, she also worked at the New York Gay and Lesbian Experimental Film Festival for 5 years, from the festival's inception in 1987 to 1992, I think, when she departed to devote more time to her writing and stuff. And I consider her like a hero of sorts, because like what she was doing, I also want to do. And I think it's very important to have this kind of intergenerational dialogue, to always take into account that there is an actual history there, which we sometimes might not be aware about. I think this is also the case with Russian LGBTQ plus community, quote unquote, because like there is no awareness that there was a history, that there were like queer authors, that there were queer filmmakers like Parajanov, that there were queer artists like Somov. So there were like, you know, all of those people, but you don't actually like discuss them or talk about them. And like, I think I asked like many people, whether like many queer people, whether they know who Evgeny Kharitonov is. And like all of them might know Magutin, but they don't know Kharitonov. And it's even more difficult with like, you know, I would say that, I think that it also might sound a bit generalizing, but I guess that lesbian and transgender people in particular are much more conscious, much more politically aware than white gay people.
Because they're more, I think that there's like minority of them being women, for example, and lesbians, and this like as well, like transgender people, they're more of a minority, I would say, and they're more oppressed. And I think that makes them to maybe think more about like their history and culture and legacy, and in a way to be more, you know, have more knowledge about their culture, I would say.
Yeah, and it's also like, you know, it's sometimes about inventing new waves of existence. Sometimes in like, you know, sometimes when you know how to do something or how to exist, even you just turn back to something like to the lived experience of someone who did that before you, And like one of my favorite theorists as well, Sadie Hartman, she has this amazing book, which is Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments. Sorry, and that book is all about the Black queer people in the beginning of the 20th century, who were like sexual radicals, who were inventing new ways of being, of carrying themselves in the world, let's say. And that experience also speaks to me because, like, sometimes it's almost feels like, because there is no like written queer history in Russia, even though some theorists are trying to do that, like Dan Healy, for example. I think his book was recently published by Garage. And also like this book by another theorist whose name I do not recall, but it was published by Individuum, like literally this month probably, which is about homosexuality in the Soviet Union. I think these kind of stories, that are, they're like super important because we need to know our roots. We need to... I'm inventing my own roots, you might say, because I like, and that is also what is very interesting about queer people, this kind of, you know, non-biological kinship that you form with people who they might have lived in different times, they might have been of different race, they might have been of different gender from you, but you feel that very special kinship with them on the basis of shared lived experience, on the basis of discrimination, let's say, but not just that. Like, you know, sometimes it can be like a more positive identification in the, like, you know, in the form of like, oh, that kind of hits too close to home, or that's like, I don't know. So it's, I'm not sure where I'm coming with all of that, but I guess the main thing is, we need a sense of history. We need a sense of kind of queer temporality, that there is a timeline, and we need to know our place on that. In Shulman's book, which I translated and which is not yet published in Russian because of the sad gay, like anti-LGBTQ plus law, which is the gentrification of the minds, Shulman, it is at once a sociological examination of the phenomenon of gentrification, and at the same time it's also her very personal memoir of the AIDS era in New York. And there is a scene in that book where she organized an exhibition with oral accounts by the survivors of the epidemic, which are displayed in a gallery, I think. And a lot of people come for the opening, and she can see like two completely separate groups. One of them is the ACT UP people, like the AIDS survivors. And the other is the younger queer crowd. And the two worlds do not really mix. They just kind of exist separately. And she describes it as something very tragic, very kind of, you know, even though the younger generation is kind of, you know, they're looking at their elders as heroes, like in a very sort of admiring way, still there is no real connection between them. And this is very sad. And I think that in Russia, I maybe only knew one or maybe two elder gay men, which is also, you know, like there was no one who could pass me that experience. I know one in Poland, another in Sweden, but in Russia, I think I don't know that many.
Yeah, but this, for me, it's the same. And I'm really like, I'm wondering, like, in near future, I hope, when the regime in Russia will collapse and hopefully the war will end, and like there will be a new society. And I'm aware that there will be a lot of years should pass before we understand what happened and try to kind of fix all the mistakes that we made. But as for young people, I'm really worried that they will now have like completely no example, no people that they would feel like they can open up to, in terms of like to open up about their sexuality, and they will have no literature, they will have no access to films. Of course they can like use VPN and stuff, but for example, if you live in a small town and maybe like you're not that progressive in terms of technology and stuff, you won't be able to find anything else as we did. But for like, at least we had, I think, some kind of period of illusionary freedom, but in a way like we were in this bubble. But at least we had hope that maybe something can change. And like, as you said, like with the screenings that you organized and like showing queer cinema, queer films, and just having some kind of hope. But now I don't see this hope anymore. And I'm also wondering if, for example, I can say for myself, if I'm willing to come back to Russia at some point and maybe like, you know, help out in like with what I can and what I can do in terms of like help LGBT youth, or like maybe try to do it from abroad. But do you think that there's some kind of responsibility on us now, being like abroad and being like in a more safe position, to speak loudly, louder than we did when we were back home, about our experience and try to do something? As you said, you did your share of activism, but I'm just thinking, is it a time to do it even more? Or is it a time to maybe focus on ourselves and like, you know, kind of nurture and preserve like our strength to do it later, back in Russia, for example?
I mean, I don't think that these things are mutually exclusive. You know, I think that one kind of comes out of another. And I'm currently reading Bell Hooks, who also was, she has only recently passed, I think, this year. Who also was a prominent Black theorist, and in her book Teaching to Transgress, which is an example of critical pedagogy, or what she calls engaged pedagogy, she says that in order to, I think she mentions some sort of not even monk, or maybe is it a philosopher, I don't know, that she refers to. So at some point she refers to some maybe Chinese philosopher who said something along the lines of, in order to teach someone, the teacher themselves have to be you cannot heal somebody without healing yourself first, you know? So yeah, you cannot really like fix something without fixing yourself. So I think that we can actually find some strength and some solace maybe in helping other people by doing that from abroad. And I'm now volunteering for this project for academics, which is Дорогие коллеги, or Dear Colleagues. And it's all about like helping academics at risk from Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia to leave their respective countries in case they feel threatened, or in case they cannot continue their research. And this is also, I think, a way to help perhaps some queer academics. And there is like this another initiative. I think it was founded by an activist from London, which is Queer Suite. And that one like is exclusively like for LGBTQ plus people from Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia again. And yeah, I think that it's crucial to help and to also educate people abroad, because I mean most of them are not really aware of what's going on. And when I was in Italy this summer, I was working at the Uzbekistan pavilion at the Venice Biennale. I also had a sort of a platform to educate people, because they came for contemporary art. But in the end, after we spoke and after it came up that I'm actually Russian, and after I kind of discussed that with them, a lot of them, came away with this new knowledge on what is actually going on. And I find that very important to spread this and to, sometimes even your sometimes it's about your body and about you just communicating this. It's not like about some process or some, I mean, it's also about that, obviously, like about going out, about like spreading leaflets and everything, about anti-war resistance. But sometimes it's just about, speaking to people and telling them what's actually going on.
And I totally agree, and I'm trying to do that, and I'm trying to like explain to my British friends like what experience I had and what experience people like in Russia are now going through, especially LGBT people. And I was thinking like, what if I had like some kind of a platform to speak to people back in Russia, and like kind of, what would I tell them in a way, like to LGBT people? Like, what would you tell people that stayed in Russia? They can't go away, and they're also LGBT. Like, what would you say to them?
I mean, I don't think I have any exact message, and I don't want to say that it gets better, because it certainly fucking
For
doesn't.
sure.
I mean, it only gets worse. Maybe that is actually the message that I would want to convey, that you have to brace yourself and to prepare yourself for worst, which sounds very pessimistic and depressing. But on the other hand, it's very kind of realist, and I think that if I would have a person in my like youth, like in my teenagehood, if I would have a person who would tell me that it actually like life actually sucks and just get ready to be I mean, just get ready for it. Yeah. But then also I would probably say that there is a multitude of human experience out there, and like there are people who think in a really radical and like unorthodox way. But sometimes those voices are overlooked and they might not be taken into account. And we should listen to those voices. And it doesn't matter like whether those are queer or straight voices, white or like non-white. We have to kind of become curious again, I would say. Maybe this is the message, like we should become curious again about finding new stuff, about like discovering stuff about this world, because we maybe this is also like one of the crucial mistakes that we all made back in Russia, was that we weren't really interested in the world. Like back at WGIK, we never really watched third cinema, the so-called third cinema from Latin America. And we never really watched any of the African cinema, even though African filmmakers have been a part of WGIK for quite some time, and they've studied at WGIK back in the Soviet Union, but also in post-Soviet times. And so even though like we studied film on a very particular basis, we still haven't watched that, which is a shame. But I guess, like,
yeah, for
shame
sure.
on our teachers then that, like, we weren't really familiarized with that cinema. So, yeah, I'm just, I guess my advice would be just become curious again in everything that surrounds us, and not just our kind of, you know, pockets of freedom where we can exist, you know, quite comfortably, but also to kind of, maybe it also has to do with leaving your comfort zone a bit, you know, maybe just just seeing the world, even though some, like, I mean, probably for Russians it's now so difficult even to, you know, to leave their country sometimes. For me, I mean, for sure, I know how difficult it was for me to travel this year. And now I want to go to the Berlinale in February, and I'm currently trying to get my German visa done. And I have no idea whether it will, you know, come to fruition, whether I will get my visa or whether I will not, because things are as they are. And yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I also really, like, have difficulties with Schengen visa as well, and need to issue it. So for now, I'm staying in the UK. But yeah, I'm so grateful that I've managed to move here before the war started and before it all happened. And yeah, I just really can't imagine now, like, what would happen if I stayed, and what would I be doing now? Like, what kind of work could I do? How would I feel, and how, like, closeted I would have to become again? Or I don't know, or maybe I would, as you said, exit my comfort zone and be more open. But for my final question, I wanted to ask you more about your book, and how did you decide to like write it in this very conservative and very very difficult times, that, like, the LGBT law has already was in the progress. I think when you published it, it was for minors, but now it's for adults as well. And I've tried looking for your book online and decided to check if it's available on any platforms, like, you know, for online reading or Litres or something. I don't know what they use now in Russia, but I've only seen it on the No Kidding Press website. So is it now available to buy in Russia, or is it only like to order in some way, like undercover way?
I mean, no, you can still pass it as a contraband. Like, you can still, it's actually what I'm trying to do right now. Like, I'm trying to get a batch of my books here, but, no, you can still,
I want to buy one. So keep that in mind.
you can still buy it freely in Russia with not, like, I don't think there would be any problem with that. It's not like, you know, pornography that you have to hide in a black, like in a black bag. it was published, I think, sometime around my birthday, probably, maybe like in the middle of October. So that was 2 months before the law has been passed. And now it's, I think on the website, there is no mentioning of homosexuality in the synopsis. But it's still on the back of the printed book, so you can still buy it. I mean, you have to take your risk into account. Like, I mean, who knows? Like, maybe in a year or so, you might be like persecuted for just storing that book. I don't know. But no, you cannot access that on any online services, but that has to do with different reasons, because it's been just too, not enough time has passed since the book has been released, like in its printed version, for it to be also, you know, available online. As for, it's interesting that you mentioned this kind of, this is like a completely side note, but then I will go back to my book. You mentioned that you were very lucky in that you moved to the UK and then you started questioning yourself whether you will have to again become closeted in terms of you being Russian. And this is very like, I can totally relate to that experience. And it's also very interesting, like, to research that, you know, from the standpoint of queer theory, how all of us Russians are now experiencing this collective shame and this kind of, you know, this experience of closetedness. Even straight people are in a closet of sorts, but that has to do not with their like sexual preferences, but with their passport and with their, you know, and with everything that it entails, which is fascinating, I think. Also, I've been thinking a lot about the idea of racial camouflage, because I do not like, I can pass for white, but I do not look Russian at all, that's for sure. And when people meet me and when we start talking, I sometimes just, you know, I tell them, take a wild guess, like when they ask me who I or like where you come from. It's fascinating because usually people cannot really place me on the map. And so I kind of become this, you know, I'm nobody, but at the same time, I can come from, you know, wherever I want to. Like I can tell them that I'm from Uzbekistan, or I can tell them that. I mean, there are a lot of options, and this is also something that is very, it is fascinating, also disturbing in a way, because you kind of lose the sense of identity. I don't think I've ever had one in the first place. Like, I think that
That's 100%. I can totally relate
My
to that.
identity was never really fixed. I never really identified myself as Russian. I probably started to identify myself as Russian after the war started, in terms of responsibility that I have to carry. And I kind of, you know, you just have to own it. You have to own your own Russianness. You have to kind of, you know, just accept it and as a fact. And then you have to work with it on detoxicizing it. I think it's not the same, but kind of, you know, Ukrainians face the same sort of. I mean, for them, it's maybe actually completely opposite, because for them, it's kind of, you know, they found their national identity. They kind of, you know, the war also paradoxically, it kind of enhanced their national identity, whereas
Yeah,
ours
for
is
sure.
completely. Like it has to be rethought, it has to be worked on. Like you have to, we have to do something about it. We cannot just leave it there. I mean, I'm possibly in denial still. Like sometimes I like I also have this kind of, you know, very simple kind of simple exit via my Korean identity. Like I can always tell people that I'm actually Korean. And this is, you know, on the one hand, I'm kind of telling the truth. I'm telling it as it is. On the other hand, it's also cheating. It's also like not really true at all, because I lived in Russia. I speak only Russian and not Korean. And I enjoyed certain privileges in Russia, which I would otherwise not enjoy in like other countries. So yeah, it's a complicated mess. It's like, you know, but we will have to work on that, like in the following years, maybe in the following decades, maybe like until our, I mean, I don't know, like, I mean, during our lifetime, perhaps we have to work on that. But going back to my book, again, I didn't really, I didn't wake up and just decide that I will write this book. It just happened naturally, and I just felt the need to tell my own story in a way how only I can do that. And I didn't want it to be like a conventional novel. I'm very much interested in queer perception of time, like in Jose Esteban Munoz, like in non-linear perception of time. And so in autofiction, I found that, like, I found the necessary form, and And I just kind of played around and just experimented with various genres, like with various personas. You might say, like, you might almost say that at some point it's like a drag show where I try on several characters, including myself, because I'm also a kind of a character. So, yeah, it was just it was a matter of kind of combining my experiments with paid writing, paid jobs, you know. So I was, and also incorporating that experience, you know, from my kind of from my precarious, you know, job, from my precarious like labor, incorporating that into my writing. So it was like, you know, and I also don't like to label it as a gay novel or as a, like, you know, because this is kind of limiting. It's more like an intersectional novel would be great. And this also, like, it's implied in the title. I mean, this kind of Korean side of it. But also, it's like, it's very sophisticated in terms of its form, in terms of thinking on how film affects our life, and not in necessarily good way, how images affect our lives. And yeah, and it is also a gay novel, but it's not just that.
Are you going to translate it to English?
I mean, I would love to, but as of yet, we've been discussing that with my publisher, and there is the, I think there is one indie publishing house from the Netherlands that wants to have it probably, but we, like, it's not really serious yet. We'll have to see into it, like, in the following months, years. I don't know. Like, it got me, like, it took me almost 6 years to publish the novel. So I don't know whether, like, I don't know when it will happen, like when the English version will happen.
But yeah, I will be looking forward to it as well, so that I can't wait to read the Russian one. Unfortunately, I couldn't order it anyway here, so maybe if you will have it anytime soon, I'm eager to read it
Yeah, we'll bring it to
and
you to
really like
London.
yeah, that
Yeah.
would be great. And also from reading the synopsis, I think it's very interesting, and I would totally recommend it to my British friends to read as well. So we'll be looking forward to it being translated to English. And wanted to have like a quick last quick question. Can you recommend me any queer film that you watched recently? I know it's a very basic question to ask a film critic, but I'm just very interested to hear from you, like one movie that you lately seen and you think that it's like totally must see film from the queer perspective.
I cannot really recommend one film because, you know, like, I watched so many of them, but I think the single best thing that I watched this year was Irma Vap by Olivia Sayas, which was a French-American co-production, and it was broadcasted by HBO, and it's an amazing TV series. But then also After Sun, which is directed by an openly lesbian filmmaker, Charlotte Wells. Also, the German film Great Freedom by Sebastian Meiser, which stars, why did I forget his name? Franz Rogowski, yeah, this kind of new star of the German cinema. And then Benediction, which I think was, it had a theatrical run here in the UK. It's a new film by the veteran queer filmmaker Terence Davis. Actually, I've been to Liverpool recently, and one of the reasons I went there was to visit 18 Kensington Street. This is where Terence Davis grew up and suffered a lot. And then also, Rebel Dykes is a great UK documentary. I think it's from last year,
Yeah,
probably.
I've seen it.
Yeah,
It's really good.
it's about this very not small, I would say, but like very intimate lesbian SM community in the UK. And yeah, and that was also very good. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, which I think will open here in the UK in late January. And yeah.
I will list all the films in the description so that all the listeners can see them, and I also will update my to watch list.
Okay.
And thank you, Misha. Thank you so much for being a part of my podcast. And yeah, looking forward to reading your book. And yeah, I will list all your links in the description. And yeah, have great holidays. And yeah, hope to see you soon in London. Thank you for listening. Please do subscribe and share. Leave comments on any platform you use for listening to podcasts. Check out the links I will leave in the description below, and please email us with your stories and suggestions for the next topics. Have a great week.